TV, omnipresent. It's everywhere. You try to find a restaurant. You try to find a simple beer and whiskey bar you can walk into now and have a shot and a beer without 14 screens surrounding you. CNN, ESPN, CNBC, MSNBC. It's just, my goodness. And they're loud to the point where you couldn't talk if you wanted to. So everybody just sits and stares at those screens, and they're everywhere. Airports, bars, restaurants, every home, classrooms, and then, of course, comes the computer, omniscient. All knowledge is now at our fingertips. And you put those three screens together, and you have a false god. Those images are a false god. And we worship them. We love our movies. We couldn't be without our TV, and our computer can tell us everything. Right it can. Last spring, honors English plebe section, okay? I'm doing Shakespeare sonnets. I get a paper from a bright kid, good kid, saying, Shakespeare wrote sonnet number 27 to Marguerite. And I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, Marguerite? That's my aunt in San Diego. Well, you didn't know her. Marguerite, I've studied Shakespeare for 35 years. I've never heard this. What is this? And then it dawns on me, and I sit at the computer and I type in Shakespeare sonnets. And up comes, boom, this list of the person to whom Shakespeare wrote every sonnet. Number 27, Marguerite of Valois. I'm going, what is this? So I click back, and it's an introduction to Shakespeare. I click back, and we go back another step. Shakespeare, the man, the playwright. I click back, and it's a Sir Francis Bacon website put together by some lunatic claiming that Sir Francis Bacon wrote all the works of Shakespeare. And Sir Francis Bacon happened to be in France before the sonnets were written and knew Marguerite of Valois, so it's obvious he wrote sonnet number 27. It is a magnificent website. Some lunatic spent money and time, and this thing is impressive, and the poor student clicked on it, and up comes lies. Lies that we take as truth. Lies that we take as truth because they've got to be true because it came up on my computer screen. It's right there on the screen. It's right there on the screen. Can't be wrong. The computer knows everything. I can find anything and everything on the internet. Yeah, except the ability to rationally distinguish a truth from a lie. That I cannot find on the internet. And in order to do that, I'm back at language, which most of those who are using the internet do not have. They have lost their reason and are incapable of distinguishing. We have, unlike the Word, which leads us to a higher reality, a reality of absolute truth, if we follow it to where it's going, we have instead the image which is falsely representing reality that makes us think it's real, that it's reality, but it is only capturing an image of a reality that we will discover, as Charles learns in Brideshead, is not real because it cannot last. And the image, therefore, changes as quickly as time itself can destroy the object being represented. That reality on the screen is totally unreal. It is not reality. The words of the sacrament are real. A Shakespeare sonnet is representing a reality of beauty that is a higher beauty that can lead one to the ultimate reality. When you go to the store, will you buy me a lemon? Is a way of conveying actual information in time to someone and creating a bond with another human being in the most simple, practical, day-to-day way, but those very bonds are being broken. Now, in the time remaining, and I'll do this quickly, I just want to jack this up one whole level, and I'm going to make the claim that the Word is to the image as story is to visceral thrill or excitement. What do we know? We know that our Lord, the Word came to us, and the Word did not give us more commandments. They're there, of course. We're told what to do. But when He taught us, He taught in parables. Our Lord taught in stories. When questions were asked, when He wanted to convey information, He taught in stories. And those parables fill the Gospels. And they are still there with us, and they are profound and brilliant, and they're the way in which, again, we can still, in the here and now, know what our Lord taught. Because why? Because obviously He knew those stories, those parables, would be handed down back in the years when men had memories and language mattered. And when a significant event occurred, such as our Lord explaining something through a story, those stories were remembered. Which means, would God come among us and teach to us in stories without putting in us a proclivity to listen to stories? And it's the reason why the two-year-old, it's the reason why my little niece today climbed up on my lap and said, read me a story. It's there. It's there in all kids. It's still there in all of us. We have a little free time. We want a story. Tell me a good story. Let's go see a story. Maybe if I can still read, I'll read a book. Okay? It's becoming increasingly a maybe, and I'm going to get to that in just a moment. Why is this? Because stories are easy to remember, and because they are ordered. I go back to Aristotle's Poetics. I always teach this. Everybody laughs at me. It's absolutely accurate. In the Poetics, talking about tragedy, he defines tragedy as the imitation of an action which is complete in itself and has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And my students go, well, I could have written that. And I say, no, you couldn't have, because it's a profound idea. And what it means is this. A story is the shaping of experience that lets us know there is movement in time from a beginning, an initial starting point, through a development, and a place where it stops. Every story is a pilgrimage, just as every human life is a pilgrimage. Coming from somewhere, moving somewhere, ending somewhere. So that a good story that is properly shaped will be shaped along those lines. It will be ordered, and it is not easy to construct a good story. Story is to literature as melody is to music, as line is to painting. I will come back to that last one in a later lecture. It is that which defines the work of art. And it is the reason why plot is the most essential thing in literature. It is, if you will, like carpentry. You have got to take the materials, assemble them. You've got to do it, build it piece by piece by piece through time until finally it is complete and it's done. It's built. And in doing that, because of the complexity, it takes thought, discipline, art, shaping, craft, all sorts of things. It is not easy to write a good story. But we respond to a good story if it is well told, makes sense, and of course approaches a truth. I will come back to this. Let me just say, it is one of the glories of Brideshead Revisited. It is a magnificently structured and ordered plot with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Wow, what an end. Because Waugh knew what our end was. And the end of his story is indeed what our end should and must be. He knew it, and he works it that way. He shapes it that way. It's magnificent. It's magnificent. Now, as opposed to narrative, I don't care if it is as simple as once upon a time there was a boy named Jack, and his mother told him to take the cow to town and sell it. We can go to Jack and the Beanstalk simplicity. We have a narrative, and a good narrative. But what has happened is that too has now been destroyed. I came to realize this. This is what just hit me in the face a week ago. I had countless students. I had many colleagues. And then I had some dear friends tell me I had to see this movie called Gladiator. And it wasn't just that I loathed it, that I was bored to distraction because obviously I had figured out the entire plot 20 minutes into the thing and there was another 2 hours to go. It was that it dawned on me the way these movies are working now. And I had been joking for years saying, all you can do in a modern movie is blow something up, then throw two people in bed, then blow something up, then kill somebody, and then throw two people back in bed. And if you're lucky, there's a big car chase at the end where it all blows up. But what suddenly hit me with Gladiator was there's a reason for that. And the reason is the same reason that all of a sudden we have digital watches rather than clocks. Yes, people are covering their wrists. We are looking at individual points in time disconnected from the flow and the sweep. If you look in the back of the room, you'll see that clock with that hand going around. The minute hand going around, okay? The second hand going around, which turns the minute hand, which turns the hour, and there's the sense of flow. It is, if you will, that clock is a narrative. Because it is looking at time as movement. A digital says, it's 8:21. Oh, it's 8:22. Oh, it's 8:27. Oh, it's 9:04. Oh, it's 11:16. Uh-uh. Isolated moments of time that don't connect. It is, if you will, fast food. Hungry, eat. Big Mac. As opposed to, it's dinner time, David. We'll have the soup. Then we'll have the salad. I was raised in America. Then we'll have some meat and potatoes. And then we'll have the dessert. And while we're sitting there and course follows course after course, we will talk. And feeding ourselves has now become an animal activity, like the seal going, ur, 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 throw out a fish. Glump. Well, the movies are now working in the same way. I go in, I sit down, I want a thrill. Which means if something hasn't blown up in the first 10 minutes, I'm out of there, I'm bored, no money, I won't tell my friends. Which is why Gladiator opens with this gigantic war scene. I didn't know who was fighting whom, why, what had gone on, but they were slicing and dicing and the blood was squirting, and I'm sitting there saying, who are these people? Do I know any of these people? Do I care about these people? Is there a reason why they're... And they'd given me the little, they do this now. In the year, blah, 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 the Romans were in the forest of blah, 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 and there were the bad guys who were doing terrible things. Let's kill. Whack, 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 whack. It has no relation to history. It has no relation to art. It has no relation to humanity. It has a relation to an image on a screen producing a visceral thrill in the one watching. And what I'm getting is excitement. Just a blood rush, if you will. And my blood is rushing as quickly as it's being pumped out on the screen. Or alternately, the sex scene. Bingo. I don't know who these people are. I don't know if they've ever met each other. I don't know what's going on. All I see are these people who are running like crazed weasels. Okay? And I don't need to be watching this. What is that doing on the screen? It makes no sense. It has nothing to do with narrative. It has nothing to do with humanity. It has nothing to do with man's fallen nature. It has to do with a visceral blood thrill. Let's have some excitement because we've got to keep the audience excited. So that every 10 minutes or so, we've got to have an explosion, a sex scene, a car chase, a murder. something to keep them excited. And as a result, what I'm finding, my students cannot respond to narrative. In order to have a narrative, you have to have what's called exposition at the beginning of the book. You have to set up the fact that we have characters, we have place, we have time, we have background, we have things that have happened, we have a history. We have certain bits or threads or strands that need to begin coming together before we can weave them together and form a tapestry, and they have no patience with that. And in fact, they cannot remember from one chapter to the next. And these books are closed to them because their ability to respond has been taken away from them. A colleague of mine, good teacher, a lady I'm fond of, teaches Victorian literature, said to me yesterday, I went in to teach David Copperfield. They can't read it. I read Copperfield in ninth grade. It changed my life. And I wasn't that particularly bright. But when she said they can't read it, they couldn't remember. Who are these people? What's happening? Is there something? Nobody's blown up yet. And the cry is, nothing's happening. The cry is, this is boring. I can't. And they cannot. And the other problem is, of course, it's written in words. And the words are now beyond them. They don't... Sentences. The words... Then they have these long sentences. And then the sentences drag on into long paragraphs. And the paragraphs stretch onto a whole page. And in that whole page, nobody's blown up. If you want a sense of the collapse of cinema, go back to Ben-Hur 40 years ago. Good movie. Compare it with Gladiator. Piece of crap 40 years later. And what has been lost is number one, narrative. Number two, film technique. The Chariot Race was filmed by a master. His name was William Wyler. He'd been working in Hollywood for decades. He knew his craft. And The Chariot Race is exciting. Except my students didn't find it so. They told me when I started criticizing Gladiator, they tried to watch Ben-Hur. It was boring. And they didn't find The Chariot Race interesting. Why? Because The Chariot Race itself is a mini-narrative. We have action. A race, we've got a beginning, a middle, and an end. We have characters in the chariots. It connects with the plot. They can't remember that long. It's gone. It's gone. Now, what does this mean? Why is this happening? Well, very simple. That ability to respond to a story is finished. They can just respond viscerally. Which means they are Pavlov's dogs. You ring a bell, they'll salivate. You lop a head off, they'll get excited. Oh, it's a great movie. I loved it. Okay? Simultaneously, there's no way a parable can touch them. For one thing, it's in language, not in images. And finally, at the largest level, if there was ever a great narrative, a hugely important story, it's the one that begins in the beginning, progresses through centuries, and as we know, will have a definitive end. And it is the greatest story ever told. And it is a narrative. And they cannot grasp it. There is no way they can begin to grasp it. The other side of this is that I now can no longer go to the movies. I cannot follow what's going on. That world is as closed to me as my world of Shakespeare and Dickens and the Bible is closed to them. They can't... again, people told me I had to see The Matrix, this thing called The Matrix. I honestly sat, because again, people I respect, I sat for an hour. I had no idea what was happening. And I'm not a dumb fella. But I could not figure out what on earth was going on. It was just, my eyes were assaulted, there was noise, there was blitz, there were things flashing all over, and on top of it, Keanu Reeves. Woo! It was thrill by thrill, instant reaction. I couldn't make head nor tail out of it. There is now, between the older generation, who grew up on stories, who loved language, and the younger generation, who has lost the power to use words, and instead can only respond to images, and cannot grasp what a narrative is, there is a great gulf fixed, and it's enormous. And you're heading out into that world. And the problem is this. Those things that they know, Gladiator, The Matrix, will not be useful for teaching them what you need to tell them. And as you try to tell them, because faith comes by hearing, they're going to have trouble understanding because they're not used to language. I am saying to you that the problem you're facing has increased tenfold, a hundredfold. I couldn't put a number on it. But you are facing a tougher task. And I wish I could give you a quick and easy solution, but I must be honest, I can't. Other than this, God will not abandon, He will not abandon His people. And you must establish a prayer life. You must insist and hold to that which is true. And you need to be prepared to be reviled and discounted and attacked when you say, those movies stink. Turn off the TV. The computer is loaded with misinformation. Don't spend much time on it. And try instead to go back to the simplicity of our Lord's parables, which are tiny, simple narratives, so maybe there's a chance there. Or repeat the same words over and over again until they begin to drill into those young skulls. Or, and most importantly, trust in Our Lady, who loves all her children and will be there for them, because we know that she is going to crush the serpent's head, and that will be real, and it will end his control. And this false world of images that he has set up that holds us all in thrall, and her Immaculate Heart will triumph. And your job is going to be to get as many souls to that point as possible. But don't kid yourself. You are going to need all of your strength, all of the training you get here, a devout life, a recognition of what has happened out there and who's in charge of it, absolute faith in God, a willingness to suffer and die for the truth, and total devotion to the Blessed Mother, whose Immaculate Heart will triumph. Thank you. We've got a few minutes. I'll be glad to take questions if there are any questions. But then, I'll be around for. I'm here through Wednesday morning. Okay, so please feel free to stop by and talk. If you don't want to ask things here, please feel free to stop by. be glad to speak with you one-on-one if you've got questions or, and by the way, having said all that, you know, I would still watch The Wizard of Oz. I love it. I have an emotional attachment to it. I can barely watch my TV. I haven't shot it yet. But it's usually now, it's for the Weather Channel. It's for the Weather Channel. I do have an unhealthy attachment to the Weather Channel. Which makes me think I know and can, you know, that it's bringing me knowledge. And they're never right. They're absolutely never right, but it's a curious thing. But I'll tell you the other thing I am doing. This happened. I got into a battle with my plebe honors section about Gladiator, and then it sort of expanded, and I was just shrieking at them, and I was. It was heated. It got ugly, which is good. You know, if you get any response from them these days, it's good. But I was making the point to them, they don't even know how to look at a film. And they were claiming, well, yes, they did. They were raised on movies. So I asked them a couple of quick questions, and they failed the quick test. So I agreed, and I am cutting back a bit on some of the literature I'm teaching, and I'm going in with a film. And I'm going to teach them how to look and what's being done to them. They don't know. I think it is possible to crack it maybe by training the eye and let the eye begin to recognize the unreality of what it's seeing. That's a dangerous proposition. I may be walking into troubled waters, and I do it with trepidation. I have never done it before. But I sincerely think it is such a disaster out there. I'm going to give it a try. I'm going to take a movie in and take it apart frame by frame so that they can see what's being done to them, how they're being manipulated. And as a result, I'll take a film that I think is a good film. Okay, something that does have substance. You can teach with that which is good. I think easier than with that which is bad. There are some who would contradict me on that. Yes?
Do you think it's possible or at all useful to even use these media to reach people?
Oh, man. I'm of two minds. Until the power goes out, which I've been saying for years, and I think will happen, we're getting glimmers of that from California. Until the power goes out, it's there. I think it can be useful. I'll give you an example. Plebe, I had last fall of 1999. Bright kid, Chinese American. Shows up in my Greek tragedy course this semester. He's a chemistry major, but he came back to take another course. And we're talking, and I can tell he's still bright. He's just smart as a whip. And I'm making some comments in class. He comes up after class, and he says, you're Catholic, aren't you? I said, yes, I am. He said, could I come and talk to you sometime? And he starts asking some questions. We start talking about Fatima. I realize, yeah, he's Catholic. Okay, he's got some background there. I said, come into my office anytime. I'll be glad to talk to you. So on Thursday, he comes in after class, and he says, you know, he said, you go to that Latin Mass, don't you? I said, yes, I do. He said, I went online and typed in Latin Mass, and it came up. Do you know this group called the Society of St. Pius X? I said, I've heard of them. He said, well, I got their website, and I read through all the material. He said, it makes a lot of sense to me. He said, over vacation when I'm at home in California, I think I'm going to take my mother and my sister because there's one of their masses nearby. I said, you go and introduce yourself to the priest afterwards. Say you're from the Naval Academy and one of my students and that this is the first Latin Mass you've been to. And then when you come back, any questions you've got, we'll sit down and talk about it. Up it came on his, you know. So, yes, in that sense. But on the other hand, the amount of destruction is overwhelming. So that's why I say I'm of two minds. It's a tough question for me to answer.
You say that the key to the suspension of judgment, of reason, of discernment, that seems to happen to most people when they watch a movie or the TV or hit the internet, is the precondition is that they're not good with words to begin with. So that if you're weak with words, then they're gullible to that general sense that we often say amongst ourselves about what these media do.
I think that's true.
So if you're good with words, you can still see through.
Not necessarily, in that I know some people who are very gifted linguistically. who are still enchanted by movies,
okay. And
have absolutely no taste when they go to see them. Absolutely no taste, and I find I cannot discuss movies rationally with them. It's a very curious process.
So I'll tell you where I'm coming from on that. Of course, I grew up in the 70s on TV, and I can remember when they were showing Leave It to Beaver reruns in old, let's say, 1973, 74. I'm 8 years old, and I was a TV junkie at the time. And I'll tell you, when those shows came on, that genre, that era, I always used to get upset.
Mm-hmm.
Viscerally upset, because I thought that the dialogue, the situations, the plot line were all insane.
But here's something else. I grew up, those aired the first time when I was that age.
Yeah.
And I have a sentimental attachment to them. Because I have memories bound up with them.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to look. It's one of the themes of the book. Memory can be a great good and it can be dangerous. In that sense, similar to what we're talking about. And much of it is time, is memory, is your condition when you watch these things. But what I'm trying to say here is I believe there is a way in which we can look objectively at these things and need to understand the danger objectively, which I'm beginning to perceive as more profound. It was the insight that came to me some years ago from His Excellency, in fact, when he explained to me the problems with modern music in which rhythm dominates. At which point it became clear to me the problem isn't the lyrics. Everybody said the problem's the lyrics. What's coming clear to me now, the problem is not that the movies have sex and violence in them. That's bad, that's not good. But the problem is the image and the collapse of narrative. We're dealing with larger problems, and that's what I'm trying to focus on now. That's what's troubling me now. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Does your Victorian lit professor friend have any idea about the problem about why they can't read Dickens?
No, and I'm going to tell you something very curious, and I mean this. You will understand what I'm saying. It is very rare to encounter a woman with whom you can discuss ideas rationally. Now, having said that, that is not in any way a criticism or a judgment. It is very rare to find a man who can respond emotionally and fully to a life situation the way a good woman can. Okay? We're talking different gifts that define who we are. But, obviously, there are men capable of great emotion. There are some women who can speak logically. She's one of them. And you can talk about ideas with her, and she can follow them until you get to religion. And she is a lapsed Catholic. And it's as if all of a sudden everything goes haywire in here. And you can follow an argument sort of step by step by step, and she'll follow it, and you get to that point, and it all goes haywire. And I'm seeing that with more and more people. It's almost as if grace is withdrawn at a certain point, and the grace needed to think clearly isn't there. And what comes to my mind is Sister Lucy's comment about the diabolical disorientation of the mind. And you can go quite clearly along a path, and suddenly, whew, it all goes kerflooey. So that is, you know, I can talk to her in a sense about the problems with the narrative and that sort of thing, but I can't get to a root cause. Because she will just stop, and we can't go beyond that point. I pray for her, and I hope at some point she will come back to the church. That's what she needs. That's what she needs. Until that point, we can sort of speak academically, but we're not going to get anywhere. Because that's the core problem. Yes.
Is it just the way that the images are conveyed? I'm thinking pictures worth a thousand words, and the sight is the most spiritual of the senses.
But look at this. A picture, and I go back to my point. If you go to a great painting, if you're lucky enough to go to a gallery, most of us go to a gallery and wander through. I'm fortunate enough to live near the National Gallery. I can now go and sit in front of the Botticelli Adoration of the Magi for an hour and look at one great painting for an hour. And that's, you know, and then I leave. But what I'm seeing is one image, one painted, made from real materials, okay? We've got a real canvas and real stuff on that canvas, shaped by an artist, and I'm watching it. If I go to the average movie, consider how many individual images I'm seeing in the space of one film. They're flying by. And what's happening now with special effects and the need to have that visceral response, it's much more brief clips. Clip, 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 you know. I'm being assaulted. I'm being assaulted with the number of images that I have to look at. One of the filmmakers I do respect, Alfred Hitchcock, always said that you didn't need dialogue in a film. If you made your film right, you could tell the story with the pictures. And he could do it, but there was a danger there. There is a real danger there. And it's that eventually the pictures come to replace the story. And then many pictures come to fill up the gap left by the missing story. And I guess my problem is the sheer abundance of flashing images. It's the eye cannot take it in, and there's no way the mind can even begin to deal with it. And it's a new phenomenon. It's really very new. I think we're seeing the effects out in the world. I really do. Yeah.
It's interesting when you bring up Ben-Hur and then Gladiator, and you talk about the chariot scene, and then there's the huge fight scene in Gladiator, and you say, okay, these people in Ben-Hur, most of them are dead, you know.
That's right.
Charlton Heston is still alive.
That's right.
It's a captured image of dead people in Gladiator. Some of the people when you see the Colosseum, that never even happened.
I know.
Those people are computer generated.
It is computer generated, which again is weird, and it looked weird. Everyone told me how brilliant it was. I'm sorry. It looked weird. There was something really strange in that. Yeah. And it just made me uneasy. Although I would also say Russell Crowe looked to me more dead than most of the dead people from Ben-Hur. I mean, everyone's talking about what a great performance it was. There's more depth and range in the Marlboro Man. I thought it was an awful performance, but then he wasn't called upon to do anything other than sort of look stoic. So he puts on his stone face and then occasionally think of his wife and child and weep. Then he puts on his stone. That was it, you know. My brother's dog can do that. Sort of a you know, you get two things out of him, too. And again, it's absolutely true. You go back in films and you have these great film personalities. And now I can't tell one from the other. They're in, they're out, they have a career that lasts 2 years, they're stars, they're gone, they all look the same, who knows who they are. You know, but I say W.C. Fields and Jimmy Stewart and Katharine Hepburn and Groucho Marx, and bam, you've got personalities there, I'll tell you. And they had careers. I don't know who these people are. Russell Crowe's gonna be gone soon. Because there's nothing there. These people don't exist. I'll tell you, one reason Mel Gibson is hung on, he's got personality. It just blazes on the screen. And you set him up against these other sort of vague, non-existent, transparent folks, and he comes on like gangbusters. He grabs the camera in the old-fashioned way. Gibson would have been a star 50 years ago. And there are almost none of them up there now you could say that of. Almost none of them. And we know why he has personality. I've got real questions about how he's using his career. At the same time, I don't know if you've heard, but apparently his 20-year-old daughter is going to become a traditional nun, which means he's doing something right at home. So, you know, it's well, yeah.
Is it the book Lost in the Cosmos?
Yes, Lost in the Cosmos. I love it. I love that book. I teach that book. I had to stop teaching that book because it was filled with contemporary references at the time it came out in the mid-80s, and now it's all gone. It's one of those great books like Pope's Dunciad that now you have to have lots of footnotes for. That will happen, but that book will survive. It is a great, great book. And but I can't teach it to the students now because I have to explain what the Incredible Hulk was. They don't know anymore. But again, that's the problem. That's the problem with those flickering images. There's not, that stuff can't be sustained. It's gone and it's replaced by, I don't know what's on now. Whatever the junk pop TV show is now that's equivalent. And it all keeps rotating. But some poor scholar is going to have to sit down and footnote the Incredible Hulk. Because Percy's book will survive. It will survive, yeah. It's a great book. It's a great book. If you don't know it, I recommend it, called Lost in the Cosmos. Yes. Yes?
You had mentioned that you recommended Brideshead to some of the fleets that were coming to the faith. I wondered what other books, if any, you recommended to those.
I have a short list that I hand out. The two first, Brideshead is first. Number two is Richard Weaver's Ideas Have Consequences. Richard Weaver's Ideas Have Consequences. Sometimes, depending on where they are, I will give some C.S. Lewis. If I have somebody who's been raised in a family with no faith whatsoever, and the idea has never even entered the mind, I'll give Lewis's Mere Christianity. I'll give Chesterton's The Everlasting Man. But again, you have to sort of judge. You have to judge the individual. You have to judge the individual. I had one student come in one time who was close to suicide, and I handed him on the spot Hamlet, which some would say was a crazy thing to do, but I mean, there it was, you know. To be or not to be, that's what you're considering. Hey, read this, bonk. So it's a dangerous thing, but it's a dangerous thing even in assigning books for a course. You're using your best judgment. There's a name from my past. This was years ago, 15 years ago. A student named Troy Bell, I remember the name, and I don't remember much anymore. I taught Dostoevsky's The Possessed, Demons, The Devils, goes under various titles. And then one day, we went through it in about 6 weeks, and he vanished from class. Bright kid, he was gone. I was called into the chairman's office. The Marine colonel, who was the head of the division, was there and asked me what I had been teaching. Because this kid apparently read the book once, read it twice, read it a third time, got Albert Camus' play version of the play, and then one night went over the wall and vanished. And nobody knew where he was. And to this day, I don't know what happened to him. But as I said to them, well, he either became a revolutionary and he's out building bombs, or he's a monk. And they thought I was being flippant. But I meant it. And I don't know where he is. I don't know what happened. So, I mean, any time you walk in and teach, any time you hand a book, you're taking a chance. But that happening was before I had discovered the traditional faith. And that was a disturbing moment. I've had nothing like that happen since. I mean, there are times I have a measure of success and feel that I've done some work with this. Well, it's his work. I'm the instrument, but feel that I've accomplished something. Other times, you know, they wander off. Couple of quick chats and they wander off. But that's not my business. I got an email from a student I'd had in the class of 96, I think it was, informing me that he had come into the Catholic Church. He'd converted. And saying to me, as I remember it, didn't you go to the Latin Mass? He said, I've been in the church. My life isn't changing. I know I'm missing something. Could you tell me where I can find a Latin Mass? Yeah, and I had no idea of this. So again, as a teacher, you're just throwing out seed. You don't know where it's going to land. You don't know, you know. I'll see the fullness of it all someday, but that's not my concern. My concern is to do the work in that class and help those students that are there. And you don't necessarily know what's happening beyond that. The important thing is you do your work and stay close to the sacraments and pray a lot and trust in God. And it's a tough, tough, mean, demonic world out there. But tomorrow we'll get to Mr. Waugh and his book, which is a great narrative and a great work of art. See you then.